This is The Takeaway for Thursday, October 5th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. President Trump landed in Las Vegas yesterday to meet with first responders and survivors of Sunday's massacre. The president offered praise for the response.
But we cannot be defined by the evil that threatens us or the violence that incites such terror. We're defined by our love, our caring, and our courage. In the darkest moments, what shines most brightly is the goodness that thrives in the hearts of our people. That goodness is our lighthouse, and our solace is knowledge that the souls of those who passed are now at peace in heaven.
Details are still coming out about the shooting. Authorities question Mary Lou Danley. She's the girlfriend of the alleged shooter. Danley, through her attorney, said she had no idea 64-year-old Stephen Paddock was planning his assault. Investigators have not identified a motive, but according to authorities with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, 12 devices known as bump fire stocks, or bump stocks for short, were found in Stephen Paddock's hotel room. Now, bump stocks can be attached to the stock of a semi-automatic rifle to help it fire much faster. On Wednesday, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein introduced a bill to ban those bump stocks, and right away, 26 other Democratic senators signed on. But some Republicans are getting on board, too. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Congressman Bill Flores of Texas, both pro-gun conservative lawmakers, said they're for banning bump stocks. In just a moment, we'll talk to Republican Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma to find out where he and his colleagues in the House are going on this. But first, the terror of Las Vegas is teaching most of Washington and much of the nation about bump stocks for the very first time. Amber Phillips is a reporter for the Fix Politics blog at the Washington Post, and she joins me now. Hi, Amber.
Hi there.
Everybody is learning about bump stocks, and policymakers are too, for the most part. I describe them as sort of an attachment to a gun. Can you explain exactly how they work?
Yeah, that's basically it. You buy it online, you put it on your semi-automatic rifle, and what it does is, well, let me back up. There's a way to make a semi-automatic rifle which fires as fast as your trigger finger can pull. You kind of put your finger out in the air and pull it back and forth like a trigger. That's as fast as you can fire rounds. There's a way to make that fire quicker. So you can just pull your finger back and your semi-automatic weapon starts firing a ton of rounds without you having to keep moving your finger. It's kind of a trick shooting thing. A lot of gun nerds, I was told by a former ATF agent, do it. But you need your hand to do it. And what this attachment does is essentially does it for you. So you attach it onto your semi-automatic rifle, and it pushes the rifle back against you. And as the rifle bounces forward, it's essentially pushing the rifle toward your trigger finger. So you don't have to move your finger, which takes time to fire these rifles. This attachment is moving it for you much faster than your finger ever could. So you're firing your semi-automatic weapon more like an automatic weapon.
Makes the gun jiggle against your finger very quickly and makes that gun behave like an automatic. Have bump stocks caught the attention of lawmakers in the past?
Once, and it kind of flew under the radar. In 2013, Senator Dianne Feinstein from California introduced a bill to ban semi-automatic weapons again. They were banned in the 90s. In 2004, Congress let that ban expire. Now you can buy them just like you could any other gun. She tried to ban them, and tucked into that bill was a ban on these accessories. And that being said, Congress has never discussed this individually.
Right, and they may be doing so now. What about regulators in the federal government?
I was told by a former ATF agent who was not involved in regulating this particular bump stock that it likely passed across their desk as just another attachment somebody wanted to make guns more fun and more interesting, that perhaps in hindsight, regulators are going, oh, wait a second, we just approved something that made a legal gun act more like an illegal gun. But for the most part, it wasn't something that caught regulators' eyes. In fact, this is really interesting that the way that the main company that makes these, Slidefire, pitched this tool to regulators was so people who perhaps don't have use of their hand, or maybe a veteran who doesn't have a hand anymore, could be able to make the gun fire more automatically without having to use their hands. So they sort of pass it off as like this thing that people who are disabled would allow them to be able to do this trick firing as well.
So if this device, Amber Phillips, this rather esoteric device, the bump stock, has only popped up, as you said, under the radar once in Congress before. Las Vegas was horrific. There's no doubt about it. But gun control usually, as we know, falls apart and falls apart quickly. What do you think is behind the apparent willingness of not only Democrats, but several Republicans now to look at a potential ban?
Yeah, and several Republicans in a couple different factions, different chambers. So that's all really interesting. That in itself, you're absolutely right, Todd, is notable. I think it's that Vegas was like a 10 on the awful scale on everything, right? Like how many guns the shooter had, how he got this corner room hotel room, all the devices, like the bump stocks that he put on, the cameras outside. Like everything was a 10 on the disaster scale. And I think that resonates with lawmakers. And then there's this one device that, once you kind of learn what it is, sounds on the surface level logically like it makes a legal gun more like an illegal gun. And that's a really simple, almost bumper sticker thing to say. Mm. Congress and Republicans in the past have been amenable to regulating and or even banning semi-automatic weapons in the past, right? So like this specific part of gun use is not necessarily out of the question, in part because of how horrific Vegas was and how easy it is to understand what this does.
Well, attention will now turn to Congress. Amber Phillips, Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The National Rifle Association had been silent on the Las Vegas shooting since it happened on Sunday, but today they issued a statement on bump stocks, saying the government should, quote, immediately review whether these devices comply with federal law. The NRA said that they're open to new regulation on bump stocks. They did not say that Congress should pass a law banning the devices. Congressman Tom Cole is a Republican from the 4th District in Oklahoma, and he's got an A voting record from the NRA. Congressman, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Congressman, are you like most of the rest of us? Did you hear about bump stocks for the first time a couple of days ago?
That's correct. I was not familiar with the technology at all.
And do you support a ban at this point?
Yeah, I think so. You know, anytime you've got a technology that takes something that's legal and turns it into something that's illegal, because automatic weapons in private hands are illegal, and I think you've got to look at it pretty carefully. So I've actually already under discussion with several members about what would be the right way to proceed legislatively. There's actually strong bipartisan interest in this. Democrats, Republicans alike, I think, are all pretty horrified about what happened in Nevada. So, again, people are giving us a hard look. They want to rifle shot legislation. That is, I don't think, at least on the Republican side, they want to be overly broad. But this is a technology that I think it's just hard to justify. I mean, I would be at a loss to think how you would defend it.
And you are hearing from lots of other Republicans, you say, who are with you on this.
It's been actually a pleasant surprise in terms of how bipartisan this is. I got calls from Democratic legislators that were working on things yesterday. Talked to two Republicans last night that are interested in drafting something. So, I think you're going to see real legislation out here fairly quickly on this.
What accounts for the apparent willingness of some of your Republican colleagues here, Mr. Cole? There were calls to ban high-capacity clips after Virginia Tech. There were calls for universal background checks after Newtown and after Orlando. All of those failed, despite some bipartisan support, some of it significant. Why is this different?
Well, I think, again, it's automatic weapons as opposed to semi-automatic weapons are clearly illegal. They have been in the United States since the 1930s. It appears that this, and I'm learning about this, to be fair, but it certainly appears this technology, again, takes what's a legal weapon and turns it into what, you know, if you sold it across the counter, would be illegal. And so I think there's a big difference between that and a clip. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of rounds a minute that something like this could spew out.
Congressman, how much did your campaign receive from the NRA or their PAC last cycle?
De minimis. In a given election cycle, I'll raise $1 million to $2 million, depending on the year. And I think they've given, in my entire career, I actually read this, I didn't know it, like $20,000 over 14 years. So they don't invest heavily in my state because, honestly, this isn't a big issue in my state. Democrats and Republicans alike are very supportive of the Second Amendment, so it doesn't crop up. It's one of these things that, again, if you really look at the gun debate, it varies by region more than by party. It really depends on what part of the country you're from in large measure as to what your views are, I think.
It would make sense that the NRA wouldn't have to pour big money into Oklahoma since it's a red state. We looked it up. It's $5,000 in the last cycle, if you're interested,
so
Congressman.
Not a lot of money in terms of what I raised. But, you know, I also point out the last Democratic congressman we had from Oklahoma actually sat on the board of the NRA. So,
right.
Again, it's not a partisan issue very much in a state like Oklahoma. It may not be a partisan issue in states in the Northeast where there's probably a different attitude amongst Republicans and Democrats alike. I think this gets much more down to region and culture in many ways than it does to partisan identity.
Timing may be really important here. Aside from the technology of bump stocks themselves, the NRA has been pretty clear over the last many years, Congressman Cole, they don't want to legislate in reaction to mass shootings and tragedies. There will be more of these, unfortunately, in America. And the timing here may be something that the NRA says to members, we don't want to do this in a reactive way. It sets a bad precedent.
Well, I think that's actually normally a very legitimate point to make. And let's take the case we're dealing with now. There's an ongoing investigation that, you know, could well reveal a lot more than we know. Now, you do worry sometimes when you legislate that there's an adverse reaction, that is, people rush to buy something when they think it might, you know, be prohibited later. So in this case, I think the evidence is pretty powerful. And again, I'm seeing reaction on both sides of the aisle to just simply a comment I made. So it tells me that there's, you know, a strong sense on a bipartisan basis. This is a technology that deserves really careful scrutiny.
All right, Mr. Cole, you know, you're known for having your finger on the pulse of the Republican leadership in the House. Are they on board with the bump stock ban?
I haven't talked to any of them about it, and that's one of those common images that's out there that's not necessarily the case.
I don't know.
Myself, I don't spend a lot of time talking to Republican leaders to ask what I should think or do.
No, I know they don't tell you what to think or do, but you know what they think or do. And usually,
I haven't talked to them about this. So, yeah. Again, we're going to move on this legislatively, regardless of what people think, although what your leaders think determines what can actually get to the floor. I don't have a magic wand. But I think on this one, people would be well advised to look carefully at this.
Tom Cole of the Oklahoma 4. Thank you, Congressman.
Hey, my privilege. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy-and-print. Staples, it's pro time. And AliveCor, working to make heart monitoring simple, continuous, and digital. AliveCor's cardia devices deliver EKGs and detect atrial fibrillation right from the user's fingertips from anywhere. More at AliveCor.com.
Thanks for joining us here on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Democratic Congressman Darren Soto has been outspoken in calling for a faster response to the crisis in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria made landfall there on September 20th. Congressman Soto represents Florida's 9th district. That's east of Tampa in central Florida. The district has one of the densest populations of Puerto Rican people in the United States. He joined us last week just before making a trip to see the devastation in Puerto Rico firsthand. He returned to the mainland on Monday. Congressman Soto, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Congressman, thanks for coming back. We had you on last week right before you left for Puerto Rico on Friday. Can you talk about what you saw down there?
Sure. Well, all the stories are true. I saw people waiting in line at dawn for groceries, shuffled in 4x4. I saw people without water in much of the island, no cell phone service outside of San Juan. We saw no power anywhere, and when we took a helicopter ride, all the forests were stripped of their leaves, and as we landed in Utuado, a rural area in the mountains, they asked me, was I from FEMA? because they hadn't seen anybody yet. So there was a lot, and there still is a lot, that needs to be done with the federal response. A few of them had seen some military at their local little hospital, but that's about it. And so one of the keys that I took back for the next day when we met with FEMA is we have to airlift supplies out. And that's something that we've been stressing over the last couple of days to really help a lot of those folks in those isolated areas.
Congressman Soto, you had been critical of FEMA's response even last week before you went down there. Now, in the meantime, the president, of course, visited Puerto Rico. And here's what he had to say about his government's response.
What I see is an incredible job done by FEMA, done by the Coast Guard, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. I think that the job of the first responders has been something like I've never seen before.
Congressman Darren Soto, there's the president saying that FEMA has done an incredible job and all the military branches have done an incredible job as well. Your response?
Listen, our heroes are doing their best. Our first responders, our FEMA folks. It's just there's not enough of them, and we don't have the assets that we need down there. If they're saying it's a job well done and things are going great, that's a severe underestimation.
Congressman, let's step back and take a look at Puerto Rico's economy just a little bit, a perennial concern in Congress, as you know. The president made remarks on this as well. Puerto Rico has about $70 billion in debt already, and there have been lots of efforts to try to restructure that. Here was President Trump on Fox News just a couple of days ago.
We're going to work something out. We have to look at their whole debt structure. You know, they owe a lot of money to your friends on Wall Street, and we're going to have to wipe that out. That's going to have to be, you can say goodbye to that.
Darren Soto, what do you think about his statement that the debt's going to have to be wiped out?
Well, the debt's certainly going to have to be dealt with, and if we can get Congress to agree to have it wiped out, you know, hallelujah. I can tell you, the island is drowning in debt. You know, they have a declining population, many people moving to New York and Central Florida, areas that I represent, Chicago, and so they're in tough shape. That really led to their grid being run down when they got hit by Hurricane Maria, and they're now under a fiscal board called PROMESA and literally have to get much of their budget approved by the bankruptcy court and by the PROMESA board. So it would be a big help to have some debt relief, and particularly if all of it was relieved, that would be a huge lift for them.
Well, it took about 24 hours for the White House budget director, Mick Mulvaney, to turn around and tell reporters not to take the president's statements word for word.
Well, you see that often, a theme where Trump goes out on a limb one way or another, kind of off script, and then they pull him back. So we're used to that in Washington.
You talked about the electrical grid, and we've reported that 75% of that grid is destroyed, Congressman. Of course, most of the island still without power. In the aftermath here, there have been calls from some sectors to say that privatization of that utility is the best thing for Puerto Rico's future and the best thing for its debt as well. How would you view moves to privatize the electrical grid there and other industries as well?
Well, in Florida, we have a mix. We have investor-owned utilities, which are private. We have municipal-owned utilities owned by cities, much like PREPA is considered. And then we have rural cooperatives, primarily in our agricultural area. So I do believe in competition, but I wouldn't force it upon the Puerto Rico government. I think we have to walk with them hand in hand to come to this conclusion. But certainly having some competition, and if we sold off some of it to a private utility that then was able to rebuild with far less or no federal dollars, that certainly would be a help.
And back on the ground on Puerto Rico, Congressman, what needs to happen today, tomorrow? What do you want to see happening in the next 24 hours in terms of relief?
So we stressed having air assets down there and airlifting supplies, that was absolutely critical, that seem to be the big missing piece in the immediate term. In addition, having better access to leave the island should people want to do so. We just had our first major cruise flight come in with 4,300 people from the island, many of them children with their parents and sick and infirm seniors that needed medical attention. So we do need to give people that option. And third, we need to get the cell phone service up and running, even if it's temporary towers, to start the communication moving. That's severely hampering both relief efforts and rebuilding efforts.
All right, Congressman Darren Soto from Florida's 9th District, we appreciate you coming back on to tell us about what you saw in Puerto Rico.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, today is the deadline for DACA recipients to apply to renew their status. Individuals in the United States through the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals were thrown into confusion when the Trump administration announced an end to that program with a 6-month delay. Then they appeared to backtrack and suggest a deal on DACA could be possible with Democrats on board. Meanwhile, Republicans on Capitol Hill on Wednesday in a House subcommittee approved a border security bill with $10 billion earmarked for President Trump's border wall. Republicans now have to decide whether they should try to attach that money to any deal on DACA with Democrats. Well, since we had both Republican Congressman Tom Cole and Democratic Congressman Darren Soto on the show, we asked them both about it. Tom Cole had this to say.
I think border security will be a component in this, but it's so supercharged. I think people use terms that are sort of misleading on both sides, quite frankly.
But Representative Darren Soto of Florida had this to say about $10 billion in funding for the border wall.
Over our dead bodies.
Two very different takes on what a deal involving a border wall and DACA could look like. This is The Takeaway. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by AliveCor, working to make heart monitoring simple, continuous, and digital. AliveCor's cardia devices deliver EKGs and detect atrial fibrillation right from the user's fingertips from anywhere. More at AliveCor.com.
Just days after Catalans voted for independence in a referendum marred by a violent crackdown by Spanish police, Catalonia's president now says he'll declare independence as early as this weekend. Spanish authorities say last weekend's referendum was illegal under the Spanish Constitution, and even the King of Spain is weighing in. He says Catalonia's moves to independence are threatening the stability of the entire country. Becker Seguin is assistant professor of Iberian Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Professor, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it appears that Catalan officials are determined to push ahead with declaring independence while Spanish authorities are determined to stop them. What's going on?
So something very curious is going on where the president of the Catalan Generalitat, the Parliament of Catalonia, Carles Puigdemont, at first declared to the international community that he wasn't going to go ahead immediately with independence. This happened on Monday. And then on Tuesday, he kind of did a 180, and he said on the BBC that he would in fact declare independence, as you said, by the end of the week, if not early next week. And so I think what's happening, at least with among the Catalan leadership, is that they're trying to, in a sense, play both sides. Puigdemont, of course, wants Catalonia to become part of the EU if it declares independence, and that hasn't been a guarantee that President Juncker or other EU member states have offered. But at the same time, he wants to appease the Catalans, the 2.26 million Catalans who voted in favor or who voted in the referendum, and 90% of which who voted in favor of independence, by saying that he is going to push very rapidly toward independence.
How important is it that the European Union and the European Commission have both kind of kept this whole situation at arm's length?
So I think it's very important, and it's very interesting in terms of just Catalan kind of polling statistics. So back in the summer of 2016, over 49%, even upwards of 50-some percent of Catalans, they were asked if there were to be a referendum tomorrow on independence, what would you vote? And that percentage, again, over 50%, said that they would vote in favor. That number in the weeks leading up to the referendum on October 1st, that number came down to about 40%. And that's because of the EU's kind of trepidation toward about including Catalonia in the European Union.
So if a declaration does come in the next few days here, Becker, what exactly would Spain be prepared to do to stop it?
So I think Spain and the government, of course, of the conservative Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy would be expected by other parties, but also I think they would want to push ahead with this, with invoking what's called Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution. And what that article does, or what that article allows, is it allows for the central government to effectively take over control of the institutions of a particular region. So Spain is divided up into 17 different regions, kind of like you can think of them as states in the United States. But it is a much more centralized government than the United States. And so there is a certain degree of autonomy that Catalonia, one of those 17 regions, is given. But all that autonomy would basically be wiped away if they were to invoke Article 155. And you could see, for example, a much stronger presence of the military, a much stronger presence of the police force than what we even saw this weekend when the Spanish government sent in over 12,000 police officers armed with riot gear. And so I could see an escalation of violence. I could see mass protests not only in Catalonia, but in other parts of Spain, especially, for example, in the Basque Country, but also in Madrid, because Madrid, as we know, has a left-wing mayor, Manuela Carmena, and she has a wide base of popular support there. So I can see this kind of turning into a huge crisis, a bigger crisis than it already is for the Spanish government.
Becker Seguin, Assistant Professor of Iberian Studies at Johns Hopkins University, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
In Southeast Asia, a new strain of malaria is showing resistance to commonly used anti-malarial drugs. Already, more than 200 million people are infected by malaria every year. It's one of the deadliest infectious diseases known. But now experts worry about what will happen if drug-resistant malaria were to spread beyond the Mekong region. Meanwhile, the U.S. government is ramping up its efforts to lessen malaria's impact overseas. Arane Cook is the acting U.S. Global Malaria Coordinator with the President's Malaria Initiative. She says drug-resistant malaria is spreading at a dangerous speed.
It's a concern because for a number of years, we've had a really effective treatment for malaria. And if the malaria parasites become resistant to that treatment, it means many, many, many more people will die.
Is this resistant form of malaria also resistant to the medications that prevent malaria?
No, we're concerned mostly about the treatment. Depending on the drug, there could be different resistance for those drugs. But the ones we're particularly concerned with is resistance to artemisinin combination therapy, which is the primary treatment for drugs.
So what do we know about where or how this resistance started?
Well, we're starting to see some resistance in the Mekong subregion, in the areas that border Thailand, Cambodia, Burma, etc. This is of concern because that's where we first started to see resistance for chloroquine, which for, 40 years ago was a really effective drug to treat malaria. But we started to see resistance for chloroquine in the 60s and 70s, and that became not an effective drug to use to treat malaria. So as a result, millions of people died.
And if this combination therapy becomes ineffective, if this resistant form spread, are there newer malaria drugs in the lab or on the horizon that could take its place?
There are some drugs in the research pipeline, but we don't have anything yet at the ready to roll out if we lose ACTs to resistance.
So how do you track the spread of this resistant form?
Well, it's done through a number of ways. You want to track treatment failures and make sure that that you've got good public health surveillance systems tracking where there might be resistance. Some of the things to do to really prevent it is make sure we can reduce the number of cases of malaria through prevention, and also making sure that people who have malaria are diagnosed quickly and put on effective treatment. It's really, really important that they get good, effective treatment.
We're talking mostly about Southeast Asia and the Mekong region, as you mentioned. But if this becomes significant, this resistant strain, how does it impact anti-malaria efforts in other zones, like Africa, where the PMI is ramping up now?
Because we've seen historically that resistance that starts in Southeast Asia can certainly spread worldwide. The President's Malaria Initiative is indeed working in Southeast Asia in the Mekong subregion. We're working very closely with our partners in country and also with the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria to really try to get on top of the resistance and reduce malaria in those countries.
So we're talking about treatment, and you mentioned how important prevention measures are. Getting rid of standing water, garbage removal, and mosquito nets still seem like they're the most important thing.
That's exactly right. So those are the most important thing. The other piece is making sure that you've got good diagnostic services and treatment services available throughout the communities and in health centers, and to make sure that the treatment that somebody is taking is of good quality. One of the other issues we have, particularly in malaria, is lots of counterfeit drugs or drugs that don't have all of the active agent to treat malaria, which means that you can sort of partly kill the parasite but not completely, and that can create more resistance.
Can you just encapsulate how good of a job the United States has been doing in getting these resources to poor people, and what could change if resistance becomes a problem?
Well, together with our partners at country level and our global partners, we've enjoyed incredible success and progress in reducing malaria deaths. We've done that by more than 60%, and over the last 12 or 15 years, saved over 7 million lives and prevented 1 billion malaria cases. That really does mean that we've been able to get the interventions to the communities that need them desperately.
Irene Cook is with the President's Malaria Initiative at USAID. Irene Cook, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us today on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's go to Yemen now, where the civil war between the government and the Houthi rebels has killed at least 5,000 civilians so far, with thousands more dead from a massive cholera epidemic and almost 200 million people on the brink of famine. Tancred Sterba is former president of Doctors Without Borders in Germany, and he's currently on the organization's International Board of Directors. Dr. Sterba has just returned from Yemen, where he spent a month working as an ER doctor in hospitals and clinics around the country.
The situation is pretty bad in Yemen today. We see basically three big challenges. One is the war, and sort of underlying is the cholera epidemic, which is now close to 800,000 people infected. It's spreading all over the country, and we see, of course, war-wounded, war-affected people, and we see also a lot of malnourished children, and these combined medical challenges are just too big to stem in a failing health structure where less than half of all the hospitals are still working.
You mentioned the triple problem, war and injuries from war, cholera and hunger, famine, which we've reported on here on The Takeaway. Those second two problems, cholera and famine, are they a result of the first?
Yes, they are. Of course, Yemen has been a poor country before the war broke out. But what we see now is that the people are so poor, they can't even afford to buy food. Sometimes they're too poor to afford the transportation to the hospital. I'll give you a small example. A family and the mother was severely sick with cholera, and she came to the hospital, and she was very, very sick, sunken eyes, the pulse, we couldn't almost palpate. So we really had to put her on IV fluids immediately to save her life. And then she was pregnant, and the next day she had sort of cramps, and the baby was born premature. Little Ali was very small, and we had to ventilate him for more than half an hour. And he was in a very unstable condition, and it took a few days before we could unite mother and child again. And that was a progressive family. The father was very caring for the family, but they just living in a village remotely from any health system. So by the time they made it to the hospital, she almost died and lost the child. So it was just pure luck that we could save both mother and child.
You know, the strain of infectious diseases and famine on the population there. But what kind of injuries are you seeing among civilians due to war?
Yeah, we see on a daily basis, we see a lot of gunshot wounds in Taiz, which is a bigger city in the frontline area. We see more than 800 casualties related to the war every single month. And the majority of them are children and women, of course, civilians not being involved in the fighting. So the toll on the civil society is huge in Yemen, and we are not seeing any end on that. And we are having really trouble getting enough resources coming into Yemen, enough doctors, nurses, sort of international aid workers to help out, because the local system is in the brink of collapse.
Meanwhile, that local system, Tancred Sterba, that helps support international work like Doctors Without Borders, has thousands of healthcare workers who aren't being paid at all. What's going on?
Yeah, it's another huge challenge, maybe one of the biggest we face now in the health system, that most of the doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers haven't been paid for a year. So all they do is voluntary work, but of course they can't afford that. They have to support their families. So despite the 1,800 staff we employ in Yemen in the sort of trauma care, in the cholera treatment centers, we also have another 1,200 staff from Ministry of Health, which we pay in order to keep those hospitals running where we work in. And that's a big challenge because, of course, a hospital without staff is not a hospital we can work in. And so to sort of keep those staff getting some sort of income so they can survive, can support their families is crucial. And sort of despite the lack of IV fluids, drugs, infrastructure, medical infrastructure, it's really a big challenge to see how these people can keep coming to work without being paid.
So what you're saying, Tancred Sturba, is that in addition to Doctors Without Borders' own medical efforts and relief efforts, you're helping to prop up the health system in Yemen and its own workers.
That's true. And it, of course, this shouldn't be our task. I mean, as a medical organization, we should focus on getting drugs and getting people sort of treated who are either affected by the war or famine or cholera, but we have to sort of support the system because it's simply nobody else is doing it. And this, of course, is something we do additionally to all the challenges we face. And there's a clear call from our side to say, please, other health actors, come in, support the staff getting sort of their salaries again, because otherwise there's no hope that this crumbling health system will ever improve again.
Has Doctors Without Borders made appeals to other international relief organizations or international governments to help in propping up the health system in Yemen, which is collapsing?
Well, very clearly, if you look at the root causes of the war in Yemen, it's an international war now with different sort of parties being involved. And of course, without sort of the political solution of that war, there's hardly any sign of improvement we can expect. So we really sort of call to all parties of the conflict to stop bombing civilians, stop bombing hospitals, and let sort of imports of medical goods and other relief items be allowed to come into Yemen, because we see that the situation gets worse by the day. And of course, an organization like us and a few others who work in the country are far too few to compensate for the cracking health system and the health support we see in the country.
Dr. Tancred Sturba with Doctors Without Borders, recently back from a month in Yemen. Doctor, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Todd.
We return to coverage of the aftermath of Sunday's shooting in Las Vegas. Now, you heard at the top of the show what could be some rare agreement in Congress over a narrow piece of gun legislation banning bump stocks. Gun control is politically toxic for many politicians in America. Here was the president asked about it Wednesday in Las Vegas.
We're not going to talk about that today,
the president said. Well, we've talked about this grim American ritual after mass shootings, calls for gun control or expanded background checks, the response that gun control just won't stop mass shootings. Maggie Kurth-Baker is senior science writer for 538, and she says that while the need to address gun violence in this country is real, thinking about the problem only after mass shootings can distort what we already know about gun violence and what can actually be done about it.
Obviously, these things are important, particularly given the fact that they are a very American phenomenon. You know, they happen here more than they happen in other countries, and they are, to the best of our knowledge, increasing in frequency. But they don't make up a big part of the kinds of gun deaths that we have in this country. Two-thirds of all the people who are killed by guns in this country die from suicide. So when we try to address gun violence only in the wake of a mass shooting, we're likely to miss the kinds of solutions that could actually help those people that make up the biggest portion of gun violence.
Break down some of the numbers. You said that two-thirds of gun deaths are suicides. What else do we know about the nature of gun injuries and gun deaths that would be useful?
So I think another thing that is useful to note is that it's really hard for us to define certain types of gun violence. So the mass shooting thing, you'll see all sorts of different numbers on it. And that's because, you know, we have a cultural understanding of what a mass shooting is. And I think I could say the words mass shooting and you would probably know exactly what I was talking about, and I would know what you were talking about if you said it. But it turns out to be really hard to kind of put that into a quantifiable position. So, you know, you've probably heard that the FBI's definition involves, you know, four or more people killed at once, basically. But that includes a whole bunch of things that neither one of us would classify as a mass shooting. So that includes, like, if somebody you know, killed all their family members in their house. It includes a lot of gang violence incidents. So if you're tracking mass shootings to include all of those things, you come up with numbers like 351 mass shootings in 2015. If you start trying to winnow that down a little bit, you come up with really different numbers. So for instance, Mother Jones, they define mass shootings as shootings in public places in which four more people died other than the shooter. Like, that public place thing is a really important part of it. And they come up with three mass shootings for 2015. So you can get really big differences in the numbers of events just based on how you define something. And none of those definitions is exactly wrong. They're just kind of counting different things in different ways.
You've written, though, about the history of mass shootings in this country. What makes them a purely American phenomenon or a mostly American phenomenon?
I definitely wouldn't say that they're a purely American phenomenon. They definitely happen in other countries. It's just that they seem to happen more frequently here. So Aaron Langford, who's a gun violence researcher, did some comparisons between multiple countries of the number of mass shootings between 1966 and 2012. And he found 90 incidents of mass shootings in the U.S. between 1966 and 2012. And the next four countries combined had 54. So this is definitely something that happens more frequently in America, and it's also something that has happened for a really long time in America. You know, there was a shooting in Winfield, Kansas in 1903, where eight concertgoers were killed when a man fired into a crowd, similar to what happened in Las Vegas. We also have a history in America of mass shootings that don't involve just one shooter. You know, historically, a lot of the mass shootings that happened in this country were gangs of armed white people going after Black Americans, going after Native Americans, and killing hundreds of people at one time.
So you mentioned suicides and how common they are and sort of where they occur with guns. What are we missing then about the public health impact of gun ownership in America when we just focus on Newtown and Orlando and Las Vegas?
I think it's important to sort of think about gun violence in terms of taxonomy. That gun violence isn't just one thing. It's a lot of different things. You know, it's not just, you know, if to put it in that kind of public health parlance, it's not just the flu. It's like five or six different diseases. And you don't treat each disease with one medicine. You have to have a lot of different ways of addressing things. So if you look at, you know, historical trends for different kinds of gun deaths, they go in different directions. You know, most of the data suggests that the number of mass shootings, similar to what happened in Las Vegas, has gone up. That's particularly true, you know, in the last 10 years, basically. But homicide rates have fallen significantly from their 1980 peak, and they've continued going down generally since most of the 21st century. And meanwhile, suicides have gone way up, with the biggest increases among women. And accidental gun deaths have fallen by half since 1980. So we have all of these different things working in different ways, affecting different people, and it's pretty unlikely that we're going to find a single silver bullet that fixes all of them.
I mean, some of this is natural reaction to media coverage, right? I mean, we talk about climate change after big hurricanes, even though the climate experts say individual hurricanes can't be attributed to climate change. But they also say, you know, it's a great time to talk about climate change because that's when it has our attention. Why is it different here?
Well, I think it's both not different and it is different. So, yeah, it is a really good time to talk about gun violence because gun violence has happened. It's something that we're all aware of, and it has made kind of a big impression on our minds and on our news cycles right now. The challenge comes when we start trying to tailor solutions too much to this one particular kind of gun violence. And that is a problem because mass shootings are really rare. You know, they happen more frequently than they used to, and they are an American phenomenon, but they're a really rare American phenomenon. So we have this bill that's sort of being discussed in Congress to ban the tool that the shooter in Las Vegas used to make his rifle fire more rounds per minute. And that could be something useful. I don't know. I don't know that anybody's actually researched what would happen if you banned those particular types of tools. But it probably wouldn't have much of an impact on the number of people who die by gun violence every year in America, because most gun deaths in America don't involve that tool already.
So what you're saying is, in reaction to Las Vegas, that this is a prime example of taking a very, very narrow approach because there was something novel about that attack, and it doesn't really say much for the overall problem of gun violence in this country.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it can actually end up being counterproductive, because if you think about, you know, those two-thirds of gun deaths that are suicides, those are people that own guns. Particularly, those are older white men in the West that are having kind of the biggest risk of suicide by gun. And those people, you know, if you're alienating them and you're not getting their buy-in on ways to prevent gun violence, you're probably actually not preventing the gun violence that is affecting them.
Maggie Kurth-Baker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maggie Kurth-Baker is senior science writer for 538. Well, since Sunday's shooting in Las Vegas, there's no doubt America's gun problem has been what you, our listeners, are talking about. We got this from Anchorage, Alaska. I live in Alaska, and guns are part of our culture and our history. Tragedies are part of life. Keep this conversation going with us online and on our website. We always want to hear from you. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE as well. That's all for us today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for businesses, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.